Hello and welcome to episode 183 of Page One, the Writer's Podcast. I'm Tarek.
I'm Marco. And thanks for joining us on the podcast, where we like to speak to writers of all kinds about their writing careers, find out how they got into the industry and try and get as many hints and tips from them as possible. And if you haven't checked out our very extensive back catalogue, this is my weekly reminder for you to do so, because there's some great names there. as ever, we have another great guest this week and someone that has worked across a variety of media.
Yep. I was going to say as well, isn't it wonderful that we always have great guests on as well?
It's amazing. I'm
sure what episode we'll have. We'll just be like,
exactly, when I introduce it. Normally we have great guests, but unfortunately this week it's a shit guest.
This guy was rubbish. Yeah.
But luckily not today.
Week. Yes, yeah.
Exactly.
This week we have a wonderful person. We have Anthony Johnson, who, as you said, Marco, this guy's done so much stuff. He's written graphic novels. He's written video games. He's written cozy crime novels. He's written productivity systems for writers, which, you know, sounds a bit too close to home for my liking. But anyway, The Coldest City, a graphic novel which is adapted as Atomic Blonde, the movie with Charlize Theron. He wrote Wasteland, which is a sprawling 60-issue comic. He, video game-wise, he wrote the script for Dead Space, for Resident Evil Village, and now he's doing cozy crime with the dog sitter Detective.
Yeah.
So, I mean, eclectic. Very, doesn't
exactly,
begin
yeah.
to, st- you know,
a
start.
A lot of variety and, a fascinating journey that he's had in the writing world. He says in the podcast that he feels he came to writing a bit late when he was only 30, which...
I mean, making up for lost time.
Yeah, which, you know, as someone that is significantly older than that and not yet published, I feel that he wasn't that late to it. But it's a great interview, and Anthony was a really interesting guy to speak with. So we'll get straight into it after a quick advert for our writer's notebook, and then we'll be back at the end of the podcast with a bit more chat and to let you know about next week's great guest as well.
Oh, it was also great.
Yes.
Wonderful. But for now, on with the podcast.
The blank page. To some, it's terrifying, an obstacle to overcome. But we prefer to think of it as an opportunity, a blank canvas to be filled with all of the adventures and characters in our head. So how to overcome that fear? Well, we all know the best advice for a writer is, write. Seriously, get words on the page and more will follow.
But what about later, when you start trying to pull those threads of what you've written together? What about the character you wrote about way back at the start? Who was she again? What was she carrying? And where did she leave the MacGuffin that she now really needs in the third act? Think about all those top thrillers you like to read. Or that amazing drama you just watched. What did they all have in common? Structure and planning.
As aspiring writers ourselves, we've tried many different methods to try and organise all the thoughts about the stories we want to tell. We've been there, searching for a piece of scrap paper to note something down, or making a quick note on our phone in between meetings.
Or sometimes we'll make a note in whatever notebook we're carrying, or a document on our laptop, so we don't forget that great idea. Let's be honest, it can all be a bit messy, and it's easy to lose track of everything. And that's when we realise it's not just the story that needs structure and planning, but the way we gather all of our thoughts about it as well.
And so we made Page One. Page One is more than just another notebook. It's a place to put down all your ideas for your latest project, divided into easy-to-use sections that will help you plan your story, so that when that blank page comes calling, you're ready to answer. And then afterwards, once it's written, we realised you need to plan how to let people read it, so we included a section relating to submissions.
Each one is designed for one project, whether you want to write a book, screenplay, a comic, or any other kind of story. We truly believe that when you use it, it will help you get to the main event, writing your story. So we hope this helps.
We can't wait to read what you come up with.
And remember, every story starts with Page One.
I always start the podcast with the same question, which is, did you always want to be a writer? Because looking over your career, you have a very eclectic writing CV, I guess. So was it always something that you wanted to do?
That's one way of putting it, eclectic, yeah. Yes, it is something that I always wanted to do. I'm actually a bit of a late starter. which is one of the reasons that I have been so prolific, because I wasn't published until I was 30. Now, I have author friends who, you know, weren't published until they were 45 or 50, but I was trying to obviously do more sort of pop culture stuff, you know, starting off in comics and games. And so I felt like I was a real late starter, and that really motivated me to do a lot of work and to really sort of burn the candle at both ends. But yes, it is something that I'd always wanted to do. I've been telling stories in one way or another since I was a child, you know, before I realized that a writer was a career, was a thing you could do for work to earn money or whatever. You know, before I even realized that there were people called writers. Yes, I was telling stories, you know, making up my own Star Wars stories after seeing the films, that sort of thing, as a child. And yeah, just always, I was a voracious reader as a child as well, which helped. And I was always just sort of, yeah, writing short stories, taking part in creative writing classes at school. I was heavily involved in drama as a child and at school as well. I wrote plays for drama festivals, directed some of them as well, and acted in them. Yeah, one way or another, stories of some kind or another, whether it's been writing them or performing them or whatever, have been a part of my life basically as far back as I can remember. You know, I was one of those kids who, as soon as I got my library card, I was down the library taking out as many books as I could, reading them all as quickly as I could, going back and getting another big, you know, as many books as I could out on that card. I wore out my library card, something fierce, because yeah, that's just, it's always what I've been primarily interested in.
And I suppose going back to the start of that, when you were wanting to tell these stories, did you have a preference? You know, was it comics? Was it graphic novels? Were they your first love, or was it books as well? Was it the same?
It was both, for sure. Yeah, because I've been reading comics as long as I've been reading books. You know, one of my earliest memories is of my father reading the Bash Street Kids to me from the Beano when I was 4 years old, before I could read myself. And I've always read comics since that day, so that has always been a part of my life and sort of storytelling. But I have also read, as soon as I could read, like I said, you know, I sort of got my library card and was devouring that, you know, raided the school library, read everything in my primary school library pretty quickly, as I recall. So it was always both. And that has continued through my life. You know, I'm primarily a novelist now rather than a graphic novelist, but I still keep my hand in. You know, I did a story for the Iron Maiden anthology that came out last year. You know, I'm working with a video game company at the moment to do some tie-in comics for them. So I keep my hand in on that side. But yeah, I've also always written prose. And my first published fiction was Frightening Curves, which was an illustrated novel. So yeah, it's always been a balancing act between those two. And then, of course, there's also the video games and everything else.
Yeah, and we'll get to that. Yeah, definitely.
You mentioned it there, Frightening Curves was your first kind of published work, and I wanted to ask you about that, because it's you called it an illustrated horror novel, which from reading about it sounded like very much like it kind of combined two of your loves, like writing prose and also doing kind of graphic arts and stuff. And I know you didn't do the artwork for it, but it seemed like a bit kind of touched bases on a few of your loves there. And I wondered, how did that come about? You know, was that something that you kind of had in your head for a while, this kind of wanting to write a book, but making it a bit more than a book, kind of combining other parts of your day job?
I wish I could say that it was a grand plan, but it really wasn't. It was, if there is a grand plan, and this is something I do a lot, is one of the things I'm really interested in is shaking up formats and doing new things. You know, a lot of my work in video games has been for new platforms at that time, or using new technology. I just find that sort of thing very interesting. I like sort of formal innovation, or innovation within formalism, I should say. And Frightening Curves was like that. What happened there was I was a member of a sort of a nascent, growing comics community, international comics community online. And one of the people involved in that community, Chad Michael Ward, who's now a film director and a music video director, started an online zine back when online zines were a thing. This was the late 90s. And I pitched an idea to do a story like that with the artist Aman Chowdhury. He's based in Los Angeles. He's primarily a commercial and advertising illustrator and storyboard artist these days, but he's done album covers for Snoop Dogg and stuff as well. And he and I came up with this idea of Frightening Curves, and originally it was, and this is why the book is formatted the way it is, originally it was a chapter a week of about 1,000 words, roughly, with one illustration, one digital painting to go alongside that chapter. And we published that weekly. I think it was every Sunday for quite a while. And that was hard work. Doing that every week was not easy. But it was really good practice, like really, really good practice. I came from the world of magazines, so I was comfortable with deadlines already. Still, doing that week in, week out, without a plan, that's the other thing. I didn't have a grand plan for the story at that time. And also for Aman, doing a digital painting every week to go alongside it. It was a real education for both of us. But it was really popular. And actually, and I think some of this is just because we didn't flake and we did actually produce it every week for the zine, but it became the most popular feature on the website. And so as we got, I think we got about halfway through and then we took a break because we'd been doing it for a while and, we were tired. And then a Scott Brown, who was another member of that community, he was just starting up an indie small press, comics press and, and publisher in the US. And he basically said to us, if you finish this for me, I will print it as a full color book, like as the first book from his independent small press. He was doing a full color illustrated novel. Absolute madness. So of course we said yes. And that's how that book came about. And I mean it's long out of print now, but there are still copies floating around. You can still find it on eBay and stuff, and I'm still pretty proud of it. It's because as well as obviously the format there is quite unusual, but if you read it, the format within the story is also unusual because there are sections where I wrote in screenplay format for no particular reason other than just I thought, well, this would be interesting to do this scene in screenplay style rather than prose. So the whole thing is kind of an experiment, and it was just getting all of my ideas out there, lots of ideas that I'd had building up to that point, throwing in lots of different genres. So it's a supernatural thriller, crime, horror, there's even bits of sci-fi in there, just chuck it all in. As so many people do with their first novel,
and from that though, you then essentially concentrated, or it seems to have been that you concentrated on the comics and graphics novels route for a while. Did that grow out of this online community that you had then? Did you have contacts and stuff that enabled that to grow?
That's exactly right, yeah. Like I say, Frightening Curves was not a graphic novel, but yes, it grew out of that community, and so I naturally used it as a sort of calling card, if you like, to get, with editors within that community. And yeah, it just sort of snowballed and grew. And yes, I did focus on the comics and graphic novels for quite a while. I didn't write another novel for, I think, 4 years before I wrote Stealing Life for Abaddon. And then it was even longer to my next novel from that. But yeah, I focused on the graphic novels and comics. And the thing about comics and graphic novels is that it's very easy to focus on them once you get into the business, because the amount of work required to make a living and the turnaround, the speed with which you have to produce, doesn't leave an awful lot of time for thinking about anything else, to be honest with you. Even somebody like me, who was doing, even in the early 2000s, I was focusing on original graphic novels rather than serialized comics, which was unusual at the time, but I believed that graphic novels was the future of the industry. And it's the format that I preferred to work in. So I did a lot of that. But even with that, the speed with which you have to produce work in that industry just meant that there wasn't a lot of time to think about other things, especially not when I was starting out and sort of scrabbling around for work.
And when you are looking for work in this area, is this Is this an area which you, you know, the people out there listening who are wanting to go into this, into kind of graphic novel, comic book writing, is it an area that you need to have an agent for, or is it an area that you can make yourself available and known to people by just doing some work and showing it around?
You absolutely can. You do not need an agent. You can have an agent. I know some comics people who have agents, but to be honest, they tend to be people who are already successful in other media, and therefore have agents and then come to comics. In my experience, comics publishers won't penalize you for... This is the other way around to how it normally is. They won't penalize you for having an agent.
Yeah.
But it's perfectly normal for you to not have an agent. It really doesn't. Yeah. It doesn't matter. Honestly, there's not that much money in comics, so the role of an agent just isn't kind of required. And there's not a lot that they can negotiate for you know, on your behalf for anyway. I actually, quick small plug, I have a piece in the Writers and Artists Yearbook, which has been running. That same piece, I think, has been in the last 5 editions consecutive, right, and it's scheduled to be in the next edition as well, which I think might be unprecedented. I think 6 editions in a row with the same article might be a first. And it is all about how to break into the comics industry. As a writer, is the perspective that I take, naturally. But it is fairly general, just talking about what's the best way to get in and, you know, get your work seen. And I do make the point there. I mentioned very specifically there that, yeah, you do not need an agent. It won't hurt you if you have one, but you absolutely do not need one. You don't need to send query letters around to agents and get representation before you can start approaching editors with comics pitches.
And we've spoken to a couple other people that have written comics. Mike Carey springs to mind, and talk to him about, you know, the actual format of writing these things. And it seems that in, you know, when you go to screenwriting, until you're established as a very, where I think you can experiment more at the edges of it, you have to follow a very technical format for a screenplay normally. Whereas with comics, it seems there is a bit more leeway in terms of how it's done. You've got Alan Moore at the extreme.
There's a
where
lot
he'll,
more.
Yeah. I think Alan Moore is like, will tell the artist every single thing that has to be in the frame, essentially. Whereas others will give a very vague description and leave a lot to the artist. I mean, where do you fall in that?
Yeah, the contrast is between you've got Alan on the one hand, who can spend 3 pages describing one panel. And then somebody like Garth Ennis, who will write 3 words, you know, dread on bike or something.
Yeah.
which he got from John Wagner, to be fair. You know, John Wagner is also very terse in his scripts. I guess if you take those as 2 ends, then I am closer to the Garth end, but not too close. You know, I'm somewhere around the middle. My philosophy is to tell the artist everything that they need to know in order to tell the story, but then leave everything else up to them. I will occasionally sort of, you know, express my preference and sort of say, oh, you know, I think this would work as such and such. But like most comics writers do, I always make a point up front of, and when I begin working with any artist, of saying, you're the artist, not me. I'm going to tell you how I think this would work best and what would suit this story. But if you have a better way of doing this visually, of representing the same idea, of telling the same story visually, then by all means go for it, because you are the artist and your artistic expression is what will bring this story to life. And so, yeah, that's why I don't over-egg my scripts, because I want the artist to feel involved. I want them to feel as if they can express themselves artistically. And also it means less work for me.
Exactly, yeah.
And I suppose it's a case of, like, you're almost leaving your ego at the door a little bit, you know, because I imagine for a lot of writers of comics, you know, I kind of see it as like, I've got this idea, I've written the script, and here's how I see it in my head. I want you to write what's in my head and make it on the paper. And I suppose being that to one side and saying, this is what I'm thinking, but, you know, it's up to you. If you're going to do it your way, go for it. That you're going to give it over a lot of control to that, and putting your own vision to one side a little bit. And I wonder, is that quite hard to do at first, or is that always quite liberating?
I think I think that's less about ego and more about professionalism. And maybe those two are the same thing in this particular context. I don't know. But to me, it's more about... You were right. There are writers, comics writers, who do that. But in my experience, they tend to be amateurs or people who are just starting out. And I don't mean that amateurs in a pejorative sense. I mean in a literal sense.
Yeah.
Once you start working professionally in the industry, you just stop doing that because you know there's no point. You know, some artists will literally just ignore you if you do that anyway, write and draw whatever they want to draw. But part of the collaboration in comics is having a good relationship with your artist. Now, I don't necessarily mean being best friends and going out for drinks together or whatever, but having a good working relationship. And part of that relationship must be built on trust. The artist must trust you enough that they're not going to just go off and draw whatever they want, you know, that they are going to tell the story that you want to tell, but you must trust that they will do it in their style to the best of their ability, better than you can, because you're not an artist. You know, if you want to do that, then become a cartoonist and draw your own comics, which some people do, and that's absolutely great. I'm not one of those people, and so I've always, I always regard it as a collaboration, and I always give artists that freedom, because I think otherwise, what's the point? Well, otherwise I'd write a book.
Yeah.
You know, where I write in my novels, it's all me. You know, I'm in charge, I do everything, and if it's great, then wonderful, I get all the acclaim, and if it's not great, then I'm the only one to blame. You know, that's just the way it is. But in comics, obviously that's not the case. And actually, I mean, funnily, professional comic writers and artists will laugh about this. It's very funny to read reviews of comics and graphic novels where it is quite clear that readers, you realize very quickly that readers simply cannot tell who's responsible for what. And I'm not saying they should be able to necessarily, but they simply don't. And they make assumptions that are almost always wrong about who, whether it's the writer or an artist that made a decision that they disagree with. Even, and this is something that I can speak to personally, even when it's two writers co-writing, they can even get that wrong. I co-wrote Daredevil for a year or two with Andy Diggle. And I remember every time somebody would, whether it was praise or criticism, would in a review or in an online comment say, oh, I loved that bit. That is such a Diggle moment, or that's such an Anthony moment, or I hated that bit. Obviously, Diggle wrote that, or Johnston wrote that. And they were always wrong. They were always, always wrong. It's hilarious.
But I suppose that you've touched on the idea, the collaborative nature of comic writing, which, you know, prose writing is often a solitary thing, at least until you get to the stage of having an editor and stuff like that, where there's a bit of a two-way discussion. But comic writing, obviously, from the start is more collaborative. And I can see the advantages that brings. But, have you ever had a situation, you don't need to say who or when, but, you know, where that collaboration hasn't quite worked out in the way that you thought it would or you hoped it would?
Yes, of course. I mean, I've been doing this for 20 years. It would be a miracle if that hadn't happened at some point. And yes, there have been the occasional stories where, yes, for one reason or another, that just hasn't happened. Either the artist and I haven't seen eye to eye, or sometimes it can be down to the editor / publisher giving one or both of us kind of the wrong idea. You know, that's happened to me before, where I realized halfway through that the artist had been kind of led to believe by the publisher that they were in charge of this project, you know, that they were the leader. And, you know, I mean, you want to talk about ego, that doesn't really, as important as the art is, of course it is, it's a visual medium. You can't have comics without artwork. But nevertheless, you know, everything starts with the script. There must be a script for the artist to work from. And so, you know, one area I do, much as it is a collaboration, I do regard myself as like, well, I'm the initiator here. I'm the one sort of with the vision to, you know, that we should all be following. And there have been a couple of instances where, as I say, not necessarily through their own fault, but where it's become clear that the artist regards themselves as having the vision, and they want me to just sort of fill in the balloons with words. And that's not, you know, that's not my style. I mean, maybe that works for some writers, but it's not for me. That's not how I want to work. But yeah, you know, you live and learn.
Yeah.
And I mean, looking at the kind of the big stuff that you've done, Wasteland was a pretty huge, you know, 6 issue.
9 years. Yeah.
9 years. Yeah. And I wondered, how do you approach writing something like that? Because you talked about when you wrote Frightening Curves, you didn't have much of an idea of where it was going, etc. But can you have that same level of kind of laid backness when it comes to a comic? You have to know how it's going to end and where, what issue, what's going to happen, etc.
For something like Wasteland, absolutely. If I'd been on a superhero comic for 4 or 5 years, then not necessarily. I think those are a lot easier to have that, you know, amorphous, well, it'll end when I end it and I won't worry about what's happening 3 years down the line.
Yeah.
But
yeah,
with something like Wasteland, which was designed to be a finite story, a long story, as you say, 60 issues, but a finite story, then you can't really do that, or at least I can't do that. So yes, that was planned to an extent. So with Wasteland, and this Wasteland itself was a concept that I've been working on since I was 18, and I was, I think, 34 when the first issue was published. There was a lot of material and research and notes and what have you that had built up over that time. But when I finally came to do it properly and sort of set it down in stone, as it were, I knew how it would start. I knew exactly how it would end. And I knew some of the points that we would hit along the way in order to tell the story and get to that ending. But I did leave myself enough room to meander and to sort of, you know, how we got between those points did change, yeah, you know, could change and did change over the course of the series. I mean, when I finished it, I still had pages and pages of notes and world building and ideas for stories to tell in that world that I just never got around to. I did not have the time or space for. And that's after 9 years and 60 issues, you know.
Yeah.
And I still didn't get to everything that I wanted to. Oh, that's also, not only that, but in the back of every issue, because I knew, because I'd done so much world building, in the back of every issue was a short text piece, like 500, 600 words, which was somebody who was unrelated to the main plot, another character in that world, who was basically a chronicler, a traveler and a chronicler, who walked through the world, and every issue you would get a different story from her encounters with something else in that world. And that was an attempt to fit more of what I'd yeah, built into the story. And like I say, I still didn't get everything in there that I wanted to. But I think having spoken to many other people who have written long maxi series like that, that's just inevitable. It seems to be that's a very, very common experience, that you have these grand plans and then you get to the end and go, I didn't get to do half of what I wanted to do. Yeah. I mean, it's a fairly small club. The number of people who have written an ongoing series, an ongoing closed, designed to be closed, yeah, ended series, yeah, like that. Yeah. There's not that many of them in comics. Yeah. There's a few more now. There were very few when I started doing Wasteland. But it still remains, yeah, a pretty small club. But that experience does seem to be universal, certainly amongst everybody in that club that I've spoken to, is, yeah, you get to the end and go, oh, I wish I'd had time to do X or Y. But the only way you would be able to do that is if you did plan everything meticulously. And I don't think you could. I don't think you'd be able to maintain your interest over, yeah, that length of time. And also, I just don't think you could, actually. I don't think it would work. I think if you tried to do that, you would inevitably wind up changing some things, and then all your plans go out the window.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, that's right. I mean, I think as well, probably if you're spending 9 years on a story, even then, it's, as you say, it's going to kind of grow. There's going to be bits that'll work better as you're writing it, and so other bits will have to go by the wayside for the sake of the story.
You're also a different writer as you go, mm-hmm, through that stage. You know, 9 years later, I was a very, very, yeah, different writer to when I first started. Now, I did stick to my planned ending for Wasteland. You know, the final issue is the final two issues, I should say, because there's the final issue of the main story, and then there's an epilogue. And they are exactly what I expected them to be. They are what I planned, what I knew, you know, it ended how I knew it would end. But even then, the way I wrote those issues was very different, I think, to how I would have written them 9, 10 years previously. So, yeah, it's inevitable that you're going to have changes along the way, and, you know, changes in interest as well. I mean, I think it was the third volume of Wasteland, I think, was completely unplanned. But I got to the end of volume two and I thought, oh, actually, there's a really interesting thing I could do here. There's a part of the world that I hadn't really thought about too much, but actually could be really interesting. And so I did. So I spent a whole volume that was completely unplanned just doing, you know, looking at that thing because it interested me. And that was totally unexpected.
You know, you've talked about the Wasteland series, but you also did a couple of graphic novels, Coda City, and a prequel after that. And I wanted to ask about your work being adapted from one medium to another, because obviously, so you yourself have written video games, comics, books, etc. But then Coda City was adapted to Atomic Blonde, and what sort of impact does having a film version of your book make on things like sales and visibility and stuff? Is it a net positive, or what was your experience like of that?
Oh, it's absolutely a net positive. I mean, the effect on sales, I think, differs according to what the title is and, you know, the zeitgeist and all that sort of thing. We did have a sales spike for Coldest City post-Atomic Blonde, or rather, I should say, around the time of release of Atomic Blonde, especially because the original was published as a hardback. And then we published a softcover version with the new title and with the movie cover on the cover of the graphic novel. And that, of course, became the best-selling edition. You know, that was what had the big sales spike. But it was only a spike. You know, it wasn't one of those books that where the sales went up and then they stayed really high forever, which does happen sometimes. And maybe if we'd managed to get a sequel off the ground, maybe that would have happened. I don't know. But it was, you know, it went up very quickly. And then it came down very quickly, just as quickly. So, but it was a net positive, absolutely, both for sales of the book, for my profile, for Sam's profile, Sam Hart, the artist. You know, he actually has really leveraged the sort of the boost to his profile. He lives in Brazil. He's British, but he grew up and still lives in Brazil. And he's, you know, comics royalty in Brazil now because of Atomic Blonde. He's really, you know, his brilliant profile absolutely went through. They're good on him. Yeah, I mean, it's fantastic. I'm very happy for him. Whereas in the American comics world, I had a flurry of, like, raised profile and interest because of the film, and then everybody, you know, forgot about me again afterwards. but it was, the experience, as I say, was, yeah, absolutely a positive one. And partly that's because one of the things that you didn't mention is I have also written adaptations. So I write a series here in the UK. I adapt the author Anthony Horowitz's Alex Rider books, which is a series of teen spy books. I adapt those to graphic novel. And I've been doing that since 2008. I also started early in my career doing lots of adaptations of Alan Moore's work for Avatar Press. So Alan, obviously, everybody knows him as a wonderful comics writer, but he has also written prose and poetry and screenplays. And Avatar basically backed up the money truck to Alan's door and said, can we have the rights to these to adapt them? And Alan said, yes, thank you very much. I'll, you know. and I was selected as Alan's official adapter. He liked, we did one book to start with, The Courtyard, which is an adaptation of a Lovecraftian short story he did, and he liked it enough that I became his official adapter for all those works at Avatar. So my point being that I, having done adaptations myself, I'd seen the other side of the desk, as it were, and that actually stood me in really good stead, because Atomic Blonde is actually more faithful than most people assume it is. It's actually, story-wise and characters, it's actually very faithful to the book. There are snatches of dialogue in the film that are lifted from the graphic novel, which is just blew my mind when I first saw that in the script. But the tone of it is obviously very, very different. And, you know, Charlize looks very different to Lorraine in the book and that sort of thing. But I was perfectly fine with it, because I understood why they were doing these things. I'd already read the screenplay. I was a co-producer, so I read the screenplay even before, you know, several drafts of the screenplay, in fact, even before it started filming. And I knew why they'd made these decisions. I knew why they were making these changes and doing these things. I understood the reason. And the main reason was simply that when you adapt any story, and this is what I found doing it myself, when you adapt any story from one medium to another, you have to change things. Mm-hmm. Because any good story takes advantage of the unique storytelling techniques and methods within the medium that it's told. And you can't adapt those to another medium. You can't move those to another medium because they're unique. That's the point. And so when you adapt it over, instead what you do is you take advantage of the new medium and you create new things, or you change things and modify things to fit them into that medium's unique storytelling techniques and methods. And that's good, because that means you're making a good story within that medium. Mm. And I said this, I literally said this face to face. The first thing I said when I got to set in Budapest to both Charlize and Dave, the director, I said, I've already written the best graphic novel that I can write. Now it's up to you to make the best film that you can. And if that means changing things, then I am all for it. As long as it's a good film. That's what I care about. I don't care how faithful it is. I care that it's a good film. And so that's what they did. So, yeah, I was very, very happy.
Yeah, like, just thinking of an example of that. I suppose with a comic, you know which page is going to... The right-hand page, you can have a sort of mini cliffhanger so that when they turn over the page, they've got a double page spread or something like that, which obviously isn't something you can directly translate to another medium, so you have to adapt things.
Not
like
only
that,
but in a comic, this is the example I always use. In a comic, and this is the only medium in which you can do this, in the comic, you can have a character speak and you do not know whether that character is a man, a woman, an alien, a zombie. Mm-hmm. You just don't know. You cannot do that in any other medium. I mean, prose is probably the closest, but even there, it's very, very tough to pull that off.
That's a really good point,
But you can't do that in film. It's literally impossible to do in film. But on the other hand, in film, you can have a 2-minute close-up of somebody's face with no dialogue, and it can be captivating. Yeah. It can be absolutely arresting, you know, and really, really engaging. In a comic, that would fall flat. I don't care who the artist is. You can't have like 10 pages that are just all a close-up, you know, splash page close-up on somebody's face. That just would not work. Yeah. There are always, as I say, these techniques and methods available in each medium which are unique to that medium, and you should take advantage of them without worrying about whether it can be adapted, because whoever's going to adapt it will always make those changes anyway. Mm.
Was it quite daunting being chosen to adapt Alan Moore, of all people's work, to comics?
Of course. Of course. It was the most terrifying thing in the world. I grew up reading Alan's comics. Like, I was a kid when Alan was still working for 2000 AD, doing things like Skiz and Halo Jones, and writing these amazing Future Shocks and Time Twisters. I was literally like a 10-year-old, 11-year-old kid at that time. So, yeah, it was terrifying. But... this is a convoluted story that I won't go into, but I'll just briefly say I got Alan's phone number and called him up, actually to talk about Hollywood stuff, but also to, you know, because at that time I'd been hired to do Courtyard and what have you, and we became friends. It turned, you know, he was great. I still call him every so often, you know, on his birthday and things like that. And he really put me at ease. Alan was really good. He is really good at putting other people at ease and reassuring them that, again, I talked about this trust between collaborators. You know, he was like, I like what you do. I've made my decision. Now you go and do, again, you know, you go and do the best you can do. Don't worry too much about what I think. And that's, I mean, I did. Of course I did. And I would, if I was going to change something drastically, I would call him up and say, Alan, you know, I've hit this thing. I can't do this in comics. I'm thinking of solving it this way. What do you think? And he would say yes, no, or most often actually suggest something completely new that I hadn't thought of that was better, because, of course, he's Alan Moore. He was actually really good about that. But it was absolutely terrifying. And even when I was doing Fashion Beast, which was the last adaptation I did of his work, and Fashion Beast was the big screenplay that he wrote with Malcolm McLaren in the 1980s that was declared unfilmable. and it kind of is. I did manage to turn it into a comic script, and we did a New York Times bestseller adaptation. You know, it was great. But even then, by that time, I'd done a lot of adaptation of his work, but I was still very, very nervous every time I sent it a script, because of course the scripts, I sent them to the publisher, and then the publisher immediately sent them to Alan to review. And every time I was still very, very nervous. But that's okay. I think having a bit of nerves, a bit of fear is good for any kind of creative endeavor, and certainly for writing. You know, it's the moment you're not nervous, that means you're being complacent, and I don't like that.
So I'm conscious I haven't asked you about your books that you've come back to, because you've come back into the world of prose after being out in the cold in the comic book world. So so you've got a couple of series now. The Bridget Sharp series you've written, a kind of MI6 spy thriller series, and now you're in the world of cozy crime, which seems so different. I mean, you've got such an eclectic taste. I find it fascinating. So tell us about your new books and how they fit into the rest of your world.
Eclectic really is the word. I mean, remember, I did things like rom-coms in comics when I was starting out, you know, and I've done westerns as well, and fantasy and sci-fi. So I really have done, you know, lots and lots of genres. But yeah, the Brigitte books, I did those immediately in the wake of Atomic Blonde, because I thought, for once in my life, I'm going to be sensible and write what people expect me to write. So I will write a spy thriller. Yes, I created Bridget Sharp, who's an MI6, a hacker who works for MI6, essentially, and deals with cyber espionage threats to the country. And there are three books in that series, which I'm very proud of. We got lots of critical acclaim, but, you know, it's no secret that sales were not the best. Who knows? It's currently being adapted for TV by Red Planet. So hopefully, you know, if that comes off, then I may well return to that series and write a fourth book. And hopefully, you know, we'd expect to see a sales bump, which would be nice after all this time. So the Dog Sitter Detective Mysteries, which is the cozy crime series, started actually during lockdown. The first lockdown was what inspired me to write those, because I was supposed to be writing the third Brigitte book. But because those are spy thrillers, they rely on foreign travel and geopolitics and the state of the world. And of course, during the first lockdown, before vaccines were anywhere on the horizon, none of us knew what the world would look like in 6 months or 12 months or 18 months' time. You know, at one point, if you remember, there were serious people were talking about the possibility that their airlines might not exist by 2021. We just had no idea what was going to happen. And so I had to put that book aside. And being the sort of restless writer that I am, I had to do something else. And so I thought, well, why don't I write something lighthearted that will kind of cheer me up a little bit? And I've always loved murder mysteries and, you know, sort of classic crime and cozy crime and what have you. But I'd never written any. And I thought, well, why don't I do that? That will cheer me up. That's lighthearted. You know, I can put a few jokes in. And then after a while, I thought, oh, and I could put dogs in as well. I love dogs, a lifelong dog lover. We'd actually just lost two dogs just before lockdown within the space of a year. So the dogs in the first Dog Sitter Detective book are not entirely like my old dogs, but, you know, not entirely unlike them either. and it worked. It sort of it cheered me up. It absolutely did the job. And then vaccines came along, and so I wrote the third Brigitte book and what have you. And I kind of put the Dog Sitter Detective draft aside. I'd finished it, but I hadn't done anything with it. And I kind of put it aside for a bit, and then it wouldn't go away. It kept sort of nagging at me, sort of saying, you know, this little idea in the back of my head going, do you know what? I'm actually a pretty good book, and I could be a series. and so I finally told... I hadn't even told my agent I'd done it. I finally told my agent that I'd written this book, and... Bless her, she's wonderful. I absolutely love my agent. Partly because she is used to my crazy ideas. She's used to me going, hey, I've had this mad idea. What about, you know, what if we did this? And she does not explode. And that is as much as I can ask for in an agent. So I sent it over to her. She loved it. We sent it out. And yes, it got picked up by Alison and Busby, who did a fantastic job with the first two books. And I'm writing the third book at the moment. And each book features a different dog. So the first book is a couple of Salukis. The second book is a Border Collie. The third book that I'm writing at the moment is a Jack Russell Terrier. Those are the dogs that we, my family, have basically all, you know, we had hounds. Not Salukis, but Saluki Crosses. I grew up with a Border Collie, and my partner grew up with a Jack Russell. So, you know, those were the three first dogs, I thought. That's fitting. I'm about to finish that, and then I need to think about the fourth book and decide what dog I'm going to put in there. But yeah, they're about a dog sitter, Gwynny Tuffle, who she's a retired actress and trying to get back into the business after the death of her father, and takes up dog sitting to make ends meet, essentially. And that's how there are different dogs in each book, because she's sitting for different dogs. They're a lot of fun. I have such fun writing them. It's actually, yeah, in some ways it doesn't feel like work, because I make myself laugh and have so much fun writing them. And fortunately, they've been really well received by readers, in contrast, to be honest, to the Brigitte Sharp books. Like I say, those were, you know, we had a lot of critical acclaim, and people who read them really liked them, but just not enough people read them. The Dog Sitter Detective books have actually sold pretty well. The first book won the Barker Book Award for fiction, which helped, and was, you know, blew my mind. And yeah, they've been quite successful, and, you know, readers have really sort of have been drawn to them, and I've got a contract to write four books so far, and I'm hoping that, you know, we'll renew that again, because it was already extended from two books. I'm hoping that it'll be extended again, and I'll as long as they want to keep publishing them, I'll keep writing them.
One point that comes up when we speak to people that have written across different genres, nowhere near the number that you have normally, but is that they often get pushed into changing their name, you know, maybe initials or a completely different pen name or whatever. But interestingly, that you have kept your name throughout it all. I mean, is it just not something that's come up between publishers and stuff? They don't mind that you've written across these different genres?
That seems to be the case, yeah. In fact, when we sent the pitch out for the Dog Sitter Detective, sent the manuscript out and the sort of, you know, the pitch for the series, my agent and I agreed that if a publisher, and we put this in the pitch, we said, if a publisher wanted me to adopt a pseudonym, because this is quite different to, you know, things I'd written before, then we were perfectly happy to do that. You know, I'd be willing to do that. We'd figure out, you know, we'd come up with a pseudonym, not a problem. But actually, we got, we had two publishers interested in the Dog Sitter Detective books, and both of them, neither of them wanted me to adopt a pseudonym. They both said, no, we'd like you to use, not just it's okay to use your own name. Yeah. They both said, no, we want you to use your own name. I still don't really know why. but maybe it's because I am known as somebody who writes all these different genres. I mean, yeah, in the fiction world, not so much, obviously. But in graphic novels and games, yeah, mm-hmm. I'm already known as somebody who flits between genres, many different genres all the time. So maybe that had an influence. I don't know. But yeah, we made the offer and they said, no, you're all right.
You mentioned it there, but I did want to ask about your game work, because you've written some pretty big games, especially the horror side of things. You know, looking at Dead Space, Resident Evil Village, a recent Silent Hill game. You know, how do you get involved in that, and what's it like writing a script for a game? Because it must be is it similar to a comic in a sense, or a comic script, or a film script, or is it? Completely different, because you don't know what the player is going to be going down. You're writing all this dialogue and stuff that someone might never hear.
Well, I mean, that's the purpose of branching dialogue and alts, as we call them, alternate lines. Okay. I mean, writing a game is very different from project to project, from publisher to publisher, and sometimes, you know, from project to project, even at the same publisher. It's never the same twice, which is one of the reasons I like it. You know, it's always interesting. Specifically writing cutscenes, when you know, my job is in a case like Resident Evil Village, for example, you know, I did help them break the story and sort of figure out the character backgrounds and what have you, but primarily my role was to write the dialogue and cutscenes throughout that game. And that was much like writing a screenplay, to be honest. You know, I had a lot of in a lot of cases, not all, but in a lot of cases, I had previs sent to me by the Japanese animation director, Miyazaki-san, who had already blocked out and prevised stuff, sometimes with colleagues in the basement, you know. People from the dev team would go down to the basement with like bits of foam and sort of act scenes out. And then I'd sort of say, oh, okay, I know, I see what you're trying to do here. Okay. And then I'd, you know, make a proper script out of that. And that was, as I say, that was much like writing a screenplay. But then again, there are other games where I'm just staring at an Excel sheet for days on end, mm-hmm. Writing, you know, various branching bits of dialogue. Or in the case of Shadow of Mordor, I wrote all the orcish insults in that game for the Nemesis system. And that was 4,000 lines.
Wow.
In a massive spreadsheet. I mean, thank goodness my producer on that project was amazing. She sent me sort of these templates, if you like, of what they needed, and all I had to do was fill in the blanks. But I still had to fill in 4,000 of those blanks, you know. So, yeah, it really is different from game to game. How I got into it, and you're right, I'm known as the horror guy within games, which I think is hilarious, because in no other medium am I known as, you know, primarily as a horror guy. But in games, it just happened. And that's because of Dead Space, really. Okay. Dead Space was such a phenomenon that it kind of cemented my, you know, my pigeonhole within games, if you like, forever. And I have done other games in other genres, but without any question, I am primarily thought of as a horror writer in games, which is fine. You know, to be clear, I have no problem with that. I like horror as a genre. And I got the Dead Space gig because I was originally hired to write the tie-in comics for Dead Space,
okay.
Which were being, because at that time I was already an established comics writer. This was 2006, I think. So I'd been writing comics professionally for 5 years at that point. And you know, had several years of non-professional comics work under my belt, you know, beforehand when I was trying to break in doing web comics and stuff. And I was hired to write the comics that, and this is the important bit, that they were developing at the same time as the game. Now, that may sound obvious and logical, but at the time it was unusual. It's very okay. unusual. Used to be the case that tie-in comics for things like video games or toy lines or even TV shows would be produced after the main thing was released. Mm-hmm. So a game would come out, or a TV show would be broadcast, or a toy line would be released. And then maybe a year or 2 years later, a comics publisher would buy the license and release some tie-in comics. And honestly, most of the time they weren't very good. And partly I think that's because there's less room to move.
Yeah.
Because, you know, the thing already exists in its prime form, if you like, in its canon form. But with Dead Space, that wasn't the case. Mm-hmm. They took a different approach, and they wanted to develop the transmedia, as we now call it, at the same time as the game. So I was working on the comics. Justin Gray and Jimmy Palmiotti were writing an anime. And Rick Remender and Warren Ellis were working on the game, all at the same time. And it's funny to me that all of us were comics people.
Yeah.
And yet I was the only one actually writing a comic. But go figure, that's who they hired. They wanted to hire comics people. And then because they were all being developed at the same time, we were all, you know, having the same discussions. We were all on the same calls. We were all in the same email threads and what have you. I was developing original stuff for the comics, which then made its way into the game, and I was taking stuff from the game and putting that into my comic scripts. And we were getting, I think it was about a year before the game was due to be released, and I just turned in the script for the second issue of the comics. And the developers, I think it was Chuck Beaver, who was in charge of narrative for the series, I think it was him who approached me directly, but anyway, basically said, we really like what you're doing with the comics. Would you like to try out for writing the game? And I bit their arm off because I've been playing video games pretty much since video games were invented, you know, or certainly since the late 1970s with, you know, Space Invaders cabinets and stuff in the local chip shop. And I'd wanted to write games for years. There was a particular game called Loom, a LucasArts adventure, that inspired me to want to write games. And then from that point on as well, some of the Silent Hill games as well really sort of cemented that desire. But I had no idea how to get into the industry. And then this is why I tell people that I kind of fell backwards into video game writing, because I wasn't originally hired for that at all. So I did this tryout for the game, and they liked it. I don't know who else did a try. I don't know who I was up against, but yeah, they liked what I did. They hired me to write the game, and none of us had any idea that it would be the success that it became, that it would be the phenomenon, a genuine phenomenon that it became. Right. But the thing is, here's the funny thing. The first Dead Space game didn't sell massive amounts. It sold about 1.5 million copies. Now, that's not toenail clippings, you know, that's good. But for a AAA video game, that's not that much. But it's one of those things where, even though it only sold that many, millions of people played it. Millions and millions of people played it, and it had a huge impact on pop culture and on video game culture as well. And that's something that you just can't predict. You can't predict, you can't control, you can't account for it. It either happens or it doesn't. And with Dead Space, it happened. As I say, none of us knew it would, none of us predicted it. You always hope, obviously, but you know, you can't predict it accurately. And suddenly, I was in demand, like quite a lot of demand as a video games writer, just because of Dead Space. And I wrote a few other entries in that series, you know, spin-offs, and I wrote the iPhone game and the Wii game, Dead Space Extraction, which I'm still very proud of. That's another one that nobody played, but I'm very proud of it. Because that was essentially, that was essentially writing a full-length screenplay. That was a massive script, you know, with, we got proper you know, stage and screen actors in to do all the characters on that. It was fantastic. Yeah, as I say, almost nobody played it, but it was a great experience doing it. I'm very proud of it. And so, yeah, as I say, I became known as a horror guy, but primarily also as a video game guy. And video games then kind of almost became more of, for a while anyway, became more of a sort of strand of my writing career, a stronger revenue stream for me than comics, just because and I had ranted about this several times before I got into games, and I still rant about it occasionally now. Games studios were not hiring professional writers. They just, you know, it was very rare. Now, that, thank goodness, that's not so rare now, and practically every studio has got professional writers on staff or will hire people like me to write their games. But in 2006, 2007, 2008, that was still not the case. Certainly, you know, going back to the 1980s, it wasn't the case at all. And so I was in on the ground floor, almost, maybe not quite the ground floor, but certainly very close to the ground floor of the professional comics writing, games writing business. You know, people like Andy Walsh and Rihanna Pratchett and Susan O'Connor were just ahead of me, but I was pretty close behind. And so, yeah, I've seen the industry change and morph a lot over those years. But at the time, like I say, just because there weren't that many of us around, we were all in pretty strong demand. And so, yeah, I found myself writing games. I've basically been writing games continually since then. So since 2008, I have never not been working on a game of some kind all the time.
Brilliant. Nice. It's interesting you say that about professional. This is a slight tangent, specific to my interest, but about video games not hiring professional writers until relatively recently, because I like my board games, and board games now are trying to tell, you know, you get these board games that are big campaign games that are meant to be narrative stories, but the trouble is sometimes the mechanics of the game and stuff are good and you enjoy it, but the writing is dreadful. You know, it's like very basic writing. And there's one game that I've played called Tainted Grail that I think was where they did hire a professional author, a Polish author, and it's actually well written and it actually engages you in the story. And it's interesting. I wonder if it's obviously not as big an industry, but it is a growing industry. I wonder if there might be room for professional writers in that area as well to tell stories if games continue down that sort of narrative strand, because it does... It does take you right out of the game, unfortunately, no matter how good the mechanics are, if the writing is terrible.
I'd like to think there's room. I mean, I love games and board games as well. I grew up playing role-playing games. You know, I just a few days ago announced I've sold my next project is a whodunit game book called Can You Solve the Murder? Which, you know, if you remember game books, Choose Your Own Adventure, Fighter Fantasy and all that, well, in this one you play a detective trying to solve a murder. So I love that sort of stuff. I grew up, you know, playing role-playing games. My first professional writing work first thing that I ever got paid for as a writer was working for Arcane magazine in the 1990s here in the UK, which was a future magazine dedicated to role-playing games and collectible card games at the time. So yeah, I love that world, and I hope that they're more amenable, or becoming more amenable to write to professional writers getting involved. Because yes, I agree with you. It's, I remember some of the old campaigns from, you know, especially from the 80s and 90s, and it's, I think it's no coincidence that the classic campaign adventures that people remember from those times, and I'm thinking of things like the Enemy Within campaign from Warhammer Fantasy Roleplay is a great example, were the ones that were really well written. You know, more so than the scenario design or dungeon design or whatever. Yeah, they remember the ones that had great stories. Because stories, you know, humans are built to listen to stories. We tell stories, we absorb stories, we are a storytelling culture. And so, as I say, I don't think it's a coincidence that those are the ones that we remember so well. I actually didn't know that board games was heading in that direction. I love board games, but I'm not in that scene. And so I'm actually really glad to hear that. That's great.
Yeah. No, just on the RPG thing, you're absolutely right, because like Call of Cthulhu role-playing
Yes, of course.
Mass of Nyarlathotep was written by a screenwriter, Larry DiTilio, and that's often like said to be the best written, best RPG campaign ever. And it is. It's exactly because of what you say. It's a great story, and it's well written, and it's got engaging characters, and that's why people like it. But just to wrap up, we haven't really asked. We've talked a lot about your writing, but we've not really talked about your processes for these different, and whether they differ between these genres. And I wanted to link that as well to your book that you've got. You've got your system, The Organized Writer, you're obviously working all the time on your writing. Do you want to tell us a little bit about how you do manage to organize and how you plan things out and stuff?
Well, I mean, the easy way to answer that is go and buy The Organized Writer.
Yes, obviously, yeah.
Because the system that I describe in that book is literally still the system that I use today. You know, that's the point of it, is that this is my system. Mm-hmm. It's been sort of battle-tested and proven over the years. To answer the original thing, in terms of my process, my actual process doesn't change that much from medium to medium, because a story is a story. There are specific, again, techniques and formats, you know, I talked about methods that are unique to each medium that you need to take into account. But my actual process of how I write a story really doesn't change that much at all. And certainly my process of how I organize my day, you know, I sit down, I'm talking to you here from my desk in my study at home. And this is the same desk where I come and sit down every morning and look at my calendar and go, what's on the calendar for today? What am I writing today? Okay. And that's, you know, and then I start writing, and I write as soon as I get up. I've done that consistently for years before I go on social media or anything like that, because I don't like polluting my brain with social media. Again, I go into this a lot more in the book. And then I do sort of, you know, I answer emails and do admin and what have you later in the day, in the afternoons and the evenings. As I say, my process in terms of how I figure out a story doesn't change really from medium to medium. But it's mostly just down to discipline more than anything. And obviously discipline can be hard. No question. It's hard for me some days as well. But I have the experience, I mean, the literal experience, to know that without that discipline, the work doesn't get done. You know, the books don't get written, the comics don't get written, the screenplays don't get written, whatever. Nothing gets written if you don't sit down and write. You know, writers must write. It's that simple. Otherwise, what are you doing? And so a lot of that is down to, as I say, the discipline to sit down and do that every day. And then a lot of the stuff in the organized writer system is about developing habits, good habits that allow you to do that without getting distracted, without getting interrupted, without your brain going off on like, oh my God, I left the gas on, or I need to call my doctor or whatever. That is discipline again, but that is the reason I say habits really rather than discipline there, is because that's how I've trained myself to do it, if you like, is by adopting these habits. I find it easier to adopt a habit than to deny myself through sheer willpower. But if I can make something a daily habit or a weekly habit or whatever, that just becomes a thing I do, like coming here and sitting at this desk every morning, then it just becomes easier, and it's one less thing that I have to think about. And that's what allows me, to get all this different work done. And, you know, again, I won't say it's easy. it's hard work. You know, I work pretty hard, if I do say so myself, but that's the job and that's what I love doing.
And what is next then? What's lined up for the next short while? Because obviously you've got a lot in the pipeline.
Yeah. Although my year, the rest of 2024, now that we've sold that book I mentioned earlier, is basically solidified. I'm full up for the year. So I'm just finishing up the third Dog Sitter Detective book at the moment, or the manuscript for that, I should say, the first draft. That's about to go off to my beta readers. And I'm going to start the fourth Dog Sitter Detective book later in the year. Also this year, I am writing another Alex Rider graphic novel script. Yeah. And I am now also, as I say, finishing the manuscript for Can You Solve the Murder? I already wrote some of it because, you know, as part of the pitch. But now I have to finish writing that as well. And I'm just looking actually at my list of things that I'm doing this week. This year. And I continue to work on a video game. So Emma Beebe, the comics writer, comics and games writer, and I are working on a game called Altered Alma, which is being developed by Two Awesome Studios and published by Critical Reflex. I think they might have a demo at GDC, which is going on just as we record this, actually. And there's a Kickstarter due to launch soon. You can pre-order it in Steam, what have you. And that's a cyberpunk Metroidvania, which also has romancing elements. You can romance the crew. you didn't want to talk about odd and eclectic games. And that's a lot of fun. We've been working on that for about 6 months now, actually. We'll be on it for at least another 6 months, I should think. There's a lot to write there. But that's great. You know, Emma and I have come up with the story and are writing all of the scripts and dialogue and what have you. And that's a lot of fun. So that occupies, you know, 1 or 2 days a week for me. And then the rest is all these various book projects that I've got on the go.
Nice. Excellent. What was the last book that you read?
So the last book I read, I'm going to pull up my Goodreads just to check. This is why I have a Goodreads. It's primarily so that I can remember what I've read, because otherwise I cannot remember. My memory is just terrible. So the last book I read was Mickey 7, the sci-fi book Ashton, which is being adapted to film, actually.
That's right.
But I will mention, and that was fine, you know, I enjoyed it fine, but I will say the book that I read before that was an advanced copy of Displeasure Island, which is the second book in Alice Bell's cozy crime series, which features a medium and her. It's a sort of Randall and Hopkirk deceased affair where a medium and her best friend, who is also a ghost, who was, you know, a young girl who was her best friend and then was killed, and now they go around together solving crimes. And that was excellent. The first book in that series is called Grave Expectations, and it was one of my favorite reads of last year, and so I was lucky enough to get sent an advanced copy of the second book, and that's really good as well. So that was my, of those two, that was my favorite. But like I say, I did enjoy Mickey 7 as well, and I'm currently reading Adrian Tchaikovsky's Children of Memory.
I really enjoyed that,
the third book in his children's series. I know Adrian, he's a great guy, and these books are just so good. So I finally got round to, but they're so long. And so, yeah, I finally got round to starting reading this. And to be fair, I only started it 2 days ago, and I'm already over 100 pages in, which is pretty good going for me. And that's just because it's so good.
Excellent.
What about the last film that you watched?
Now I'm going to call up my Letterboxd, which I use for exactly the same reason, because otherwise I would not remember the so actually the last few things I watched were documentaries.
Nice.
I'm looking at my letterbox, and yeah, so I watched the Bee Gees documentary, How Can You Mend a Broken Heart? I love the Bee Gees. I watched the Dieter Rams documentary, which is just called Rams, and then I watched the Wham! Documentary, which is just called Wham! The last fictional film that I watched was A Haunting in Venice. The third Branagh Poirot film, yeah, which I actually quite liked. All of the Branagh Poirot films are good, they're competent. None of them have been spectacular, but I liked Haunting in Venice a lot more than Death on the Nile, which I thought was a bit poor, to be honest with you. But Haunting in Venice, I mean, it deviates so far from the original story. From Agatha Christie's original story, that it may as well be a completely original screenplay. But regardless of that, yeah, I did actually quite enjoy it. You know, if you enjoyed forget Death and the Nile, but if you enjoyed his version of Murder on the Orient Express, then I would recommend A Haunting in Venice for sure.
Yes.
And what about TV? What are you watching on TV at the moment?
Well, last night I watched an old John Pertwee Doctor Who series, which really, what am I enjoying at the moment, contemporary series wise? I'm working my way through the latest season of Father Brown on iPlayer, which started in January. Other than that, I'm not actually watching an awful lot of telly at the moment, and that's, to be perfectly honest with you, that's mainly because my partner's playing through the new Yakuza game at the moment, so that's commandeered the TV.
The very last thing we do is a super quick fire either or, and I always say there's no right answer here apart from perhaps one, but we'll start off with let's do Resident Evil or Silent Hill.
Silent Hill, I'm afraid. You know, I'm on record as this. I like the Resident Evil games, and obviously, you know, Resident Evil Village was another phenomenon that I was very lucky to be involved with. But my heart, you know, really is always with Silent Hill.
Are you excited for the Silent Hill 2 remake coming out soon?
I am.
TV or cinema?
I'm going to say cinema just because, and I was actually thinking about this the other day, modern TV is closer to cinema than it has ever been.
Mm-hmm.
You know, TV shows these days are more like long films, long multi-part films than they have ever been. And so I think cinema has to win out as the sort of the prime mover there.
Nice. Music or no music when you're writing?
Oh, music. Just not even just when I'm writing, just music all the time. I am an absolute music fiend. This is another thing that I've been into music, and I mean into music, since I was a child. I am always listening to music. When Walkmans were first invented, that was it. I just clamp on the headphones, and everywhere I went, I had music with me. I am a musician. I was in bands when I was younger. I make my own ambient techno music now. I love music. I listen to, when I'm working, I listen to primarily instrumental music. So classical, soundtracks, ambient techno, instrumental folk, that sort of thing. New age music as well. But I love music of all kinds. I do a podcast called Thrash It Out, which is all about heavy metal. And, I've been a metalhead since I was a kid. I'm an old goth as well. And, I love music in all its forms.
Night owl or early bird? I think early bird, given what you said earlier.
Yeah, definitely an early bird. I used to be a night owl. When I was younger, I was a night owl. I would stay up and, stay up until the early hours of the morning. I would work until the early hours of the morning. And then as I've gotten older, that's just completely reversed. And now I'm very much... I wouldn't call myself a morning person. I'm not particularly good-tempered in the morning. But it is when I have the most energy and when my brain is most alert and when I do my best work.
And last one then, let's go real book or ebook?
Real book. I like ebooks. I have a Kindle. I read ebooks all the time, but there is nothing quite like a real physical book. The smell of the pages, the turn of the pages, holding it in your hand, the feel of it in your hand as you're reading.
I get this weird smell people going about.
But it's true.
Tarek is the ebook advocate.
There is nothing like that new book smell. Oh, it's fantastic.
I agree.
I mean, like I say, nothing against e-books whatsoever, but given the choice, I will always go for a physical book.
Fair enough.
Excellent.
No battery. Battery never runs out.
Exactly.
Not so good against water, though.
Well, thanks very much to Anthony for coming on the podcast. I really enjoyed that. And, you know, for someone, as you said at the start, that has had such an eclectic writing career so far and written across all these different media, I still find it very strange that he's ended up in the world of cozy crime. It's not where you would have predicted him to land.
It seems almost the opposite end of the spectrum, doesn't it, for him? He's done all this kind of, you know, thrillery, action-y,
horror, computer games.
Post-apocalyptic stuff, etc. Now it's but I guess it just shows that he's obviously, you know, someone who's not reined in by genre or by certain ideas, and he's happy to kind of jump and throw himself into different areas, and as we said before, someone who also keeps his name. You know, often we see people using different pen names, but that's probably part of his appeal. It's just that he writes all this stuff and does all of it so well.
Yeah, and I think as well probably. You know, that, and we spoke about this a bit, about that sort of discipline of writing a comic or a chat. I think with his first novel was an illustrated novel where he was writing it every week or whatever. That sort of professionalism, I guess, and the deadline, which was where his organised writer system comes in and stuff, it probably helps him to be able to work across these different genres. But one thing I'm not envious of is the writing of 4,000 orcish insults for Shadow of Mordor. By about insult 10, I would have started to run out.
I was going to say, I think after I got to like 50, I would be, I don't even know how you, I mean, it's just 4,000 is so many.
Yeah.
It's so many insults to do. I don't even know. I don't know if I could do one. And also, how does it even work? Do you write an insult? I wish I'd asked him now. Do you write an insult in English and then you translate it? Or do you start from the Orcish and then work?
Oh, I was assuming it was just sort of, was it in Orcish language? I didn't even realise that. I thought it was just what orcs said in an insulting
Probably because I suppose it's manner, I suppose because they're shouting at in English as you play.
But in any event, it's
difficult.
A tricky one, yeah, exactly. But thanks very much to Anthony for coming on, and we'll put a link to his books and other media in the podcast description. But as I hinted at the start of the podcast, we have another great guest next week.
We do indeed. Mr. Gareth Brown is joining us next week, who is a debut author. His book is titled The Book of Doors, which has just recently been released and to wide acclaim and fantastic success, you know, foreign rights in 20 countries. It's been quite a huge critical acclaim, etc. It's a very, you know, a book about books, which, as we hear from Gareth, is quite a
always appealing to publishers.
Yeah. Topic, yeah, exactly. So it's a really interesting chat about going from someone like Anthony Johnson, who is super well established. We're going to the other end of the scale here, and it's good hearing about what the current market is like. I think for people who are just starting out.
And also, I think Gareth brings some of that, I guess, Scottish pragmatism to his writing, and you know, some real honesty about what it means to be a writer and what you have to be willing to do and when to move on from projects that aren't working and things like that. So it's a really interesting chat, so please do tune in for that one. If you enjoyed today's episode, please do take time to rate and review us on Apple Podcasts or whatever your favorite podcast app is, as that always helps us to continue to get these great guests on the podcast.
And of course, if you want to get in touch, there are a variety of ways. The most simple one is an email. Just fire us off an email to podcast@writegear.co.uk, or you can find us on the usual social media by just searching for @UKPageOne.
But otherwise, we will be back next week with a great interview, as I've said, and have a great week, and we'll speak to you then.
See you later.